A Contra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into something truly fascinating, the world of Egyptian mythology.
That's right. And our guide is Geraldine Pinch's excellent book, Egyptian Myth.
Okay, so let's unpack this. When most of us think about ancient Egypt, we probably picture things that are, well, static, right? Pharaohs, pyramids, sort of frozen in time.
That's the common image. But according to Pinch, that view is really quite flawed.
How so?
Well, she argues Egyptian mythology wasn't this dusty, rigid set of stories, not at all. It was alive, a constantly evolving belief system spanning 3,000 years.
Wow, 3,000 years.
Exactly. She calls it a living toolkit. Think of it like the functional operating system for their entire civilization. It helped maintain order, provide purpose.
A living toolkit. I like that. It shifts the perspective completely. So our mission for this deep dive is kind of shortcut then, to understand how they use this toolkit.
Precisely. They weren't just reciting myths, they were actively using them to uphold Maat. That's the concept of cosmic order, truth, balance.
Okay, Maat Manat. That sounds central.
It is. And they used myths to legitimize the pharaoh's power and, maybe most importantly for the individual, to try and guarantee personal eternity, a path to the afterlife.
And Pinch's core idea, our main thesis, what is that?
It's that the mythology's greatest strength was actually its flexibility, its adaptability. It provided meaning and continuity, not despite having contradictions, but sort of because it could be constantly reinterpreted over those millennia. It adapted to new situations, new rulers.
That's really interesting. Flexibility is a feature, not a bug.
Okay.
Okay, so to get this, we need to understand our guide. Who is Geraldine Pinch?
Yeah.
What makes her perspective stand out?
Sure. Geraldine Pinch is a well-respected British Egyptologist. She's an Oxford graduate, has connections with the British Museum, very credible credentials.
Right.
But what makes her approach, I think, particularly insightful is that she doesn't just focus on the sort of high-level state theology you see carved on temple walls.
Ah, okay. So she goes broader.
Much broader. She really tries to bridge that gap between rigorous scholarship and something accessible to everyone. And she does that by including popular religion, household beliefs, you know, everyday magic, the crucial role of goddesses.
That sounds way more complete, a holistic view.
Exactly. It shows how these myths actually functioned across all levels of society, from the palace right down to the farmer's field.
And this leads her to a pretty major correction, doesn't it, about how we should think about their religious texts.
It does. She makes it clear. There was no single Egyptian Bible, no one definitive book of myths.
So more like a collection.
Think of it as a vast, fluid reservoir of stories. Different places, different times, different groups, they all drew from this reservoir and adapted the stories. That's why the system lasted 3,000 years. It valued flexibility over rigid dogma.
Right. It could bend without breaking when a new pharaoh came along. Or society faced a new challenge. They could reinterpret the myths to fit.
That's the idea.
Okay. You mentioned the operating system. You really can't talk about that without the landscape it ran on. Pinch argues their geography was almost their destiny. What does the land itself tell us?
It's absolutely key. She points to this fundamental duality in their physical world. You had the Nile Valley, the Black Land, predictable, fertile, life-giving thanks to the annual flood.
That's the source of stability.
Exactly. That represented Maat, divine order, truth, balance, everything good.
And then right next door.
You had the complete opposite, the vast, harsh, unpredictable desert red land, total chaos.
So that's Isfet, disorder, injustice.
Precisely, Isfet. And these weren't just places on a map. They were cosmic forces constantly in tension. Order versus chaos.
So basically every myth, every ritual is fundamentally about upholding Maat, keeping that chaos, Isfet, at bay.
You've got it. From the pharaoh's duties down to prayers whispered at home. It's all about maintaining that balance.
Which brings us to something that can feel, well, really strange from our modern perspective. Their comfort with contradiction. Multiplicity, you called it.
Yes, multiplicity. They seemed perfectly comfortable accepting multiple, often contradictory creation stories at the same time. They didn't seem to feel this need we often have to reconcile everything into one single, neat narrative.
That's fascinating. How did that work? Politically, religiously, can you give an example of this multiplicity?
Sure. Take the creation of the world. In one major religious center, Heliopolis, the dominant story was that the sun god, Adam Ra, physically emerged from the primordial waters, from none.
Okay, a physical act.
Right. He created the first gods through, well, sneezing or spitting, depending on the version. It's very tangible, very bodily.
But that wasn't the only story, was it? What about Memphis?
Ah, yes. Memphis, another hugely important city, had a completely different take. Their priests promoted the god Ta. He was the craftsman god.
So how did he create things?
Not physically. Ta created through intellect and speech. He conceived the entire world in his mind through thought and then brought it into existence simply by speaking the word.
Wow. So one is physical emergence, the other is creation through pure thought and language.
Exactly. Abstract intellectual creation versus physical creation. And both were considered valid. It just depended on, you know, where you were, what time period, which tradition you followed.
The acceptance of layered truths.
By the way.
It's a huge takeaway right there. Okay, so creation myths explain the start. What about keeping it all going? The cycles seem crucial here.
Absolutely crucial. They explain the ongoing drama of maintaining the cosmos, and they tie directly into the human experience of life, death, and rebirth.
So let's start with the big one, the sun god Ra.
The solar cycle is the heartbeat of the cosmos. Every single day, Ra sails across the sky in his solar bark, bringing light and life. That's the part we see.
But the real action, the danger, happens at night.
That's right. The truly perilous journey is his nightly voyage through the Duat, the underworld. This isn't a peaceful rest. It's a 12-hour battle for existence.
The Duat. What made it so dangerous?
It was the realm of chaos. According to texts like the Amduat, Ra had to navigate treacherous waters and face terrifying demons. But the ultimate threat, the embodiment of Isfet, was the colossal serpent demon Apep.
Apep, what was his goal? To kill Ra?
Not exactly kill, but worse, to stop the solar bark, to halt time itself. If Apep succeeded, the sun wouldn't rise and the universe would dissolve back into chaos. Permanent Isfet.
So Ra's victory each night was essential for everything.
For literally everything. His successful journey, often aided by other gods and magic, guaranteed the defeat of chaos and the renewal of the world each dawn. It was an active struggle every single night.
Wow. Okay, so Ra's cycle keeps the universe going.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the individual? Where did they find hope for their own renewal?
That comes from the other major cycle, the Osirian blueprint. This is the myth that provides the model for personal resurrection and eternal life.
The story of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. Give us the essentials.
Okay, so the core drama. Osiris, the wise king representing order, is brutally murdered and dismembered by his jealous brother, Seth. Seth is often associated with the desert, with chaos, with Isfet.
A devastating blow to Maat.
The ultimate blow. But then comes the power of devotion and, crucially, magic. Isis, Osiris's wife and a powerful magician, refuses to accept his death.
She finds the pieces.
Painstakingly, yes. She gathers the scattered parts of his body and uses her potent magic, her Heka, to reassemble him and bring him back to life just long enough.
To conceive their son, Horus.
Right, exactly. And that act of resurrection, even though Osiris then becomes ruler of the afterlife, not the living world, changes everything for humanity.
How so?
Because Osiris successfully overcame death, he provided the essential pattern, the blueprint, for every single Egyptian to achieve their own resurrection and eternal life in the underworld, which he now ruled.
It offers personal hope, and politically.
Politically, it cemented the ideology of divine kingship for 3,000 years. The living pharaoh was seen as the embodiment of Horus, Osiris's rightful heir, the defender of Maat on Earth.
And the dead pharaoh.
The dead pharaoh became Osiris, joining the cycle of eternal renewal, ensuring the land's fertility from the afterlife. You see how myth, religion, politics, it's all interwoven. Inseparable.
Completely. Okay, let's talk about that personal eternity. It wasn't automatic, was it? There was a final test, a judgment.
Oh, absolutely. Navigating the Duat, using spells from texts like the Book of the Dead, was just part of the journey. The ultimate hurdle was the final judgment.
Before we get to the judgment itself, what part of the person was actually being judged? They had a complex idea of the soul, didn't they?
Incredibly complex, but the key components for the afterlife journey were the Ka and the Ba. Think of the Ka as your vital life force, your spiritual double, the energy that sustained you.
Like a personal battery.
Sort of, yeah. And the Ba was more like your personality, your individual consciousness. It was often depicted as a human-headed bird, able to travel between the tomb and the world of the living.
So the Ka and Ba needed to make it to the judgment.
They did. They journeyed to the Hall of Two Truths for the main event, the weighing of the heart.
This sounds incredibly dramatic. paint the picture for us.
It is. The deceased person's heart, which the Egyptians believed was the center of intellect, emotion, and morality, was placed on one pan of a huge scale.
And on the other pan?
The single, delicate feather of Maat. The feather representing truth, order, and justice. The god Anubis typically supervised the weighing, while Thoth, the god of wisdom, recorded the result.
That moment must have been terrifying, your entire existence hanging in the balance.
Absolutely. It was the ultimate moral reckoning. If you had lived a good life, a life in accordance with Maat, your heart would be light. It would balance perfectly against the feather.
And the verdict?
You'd be declared true of voice. Vindicated, and granted passage to the Field of Reeds, a blissful, idealized version of Egypt, an eternal paradise.
But if your heart was heavy,
yeah,
weighed down by sin, by actions against Maat.
The alternative wasn't hellfire or eternal torment like in some other traditions. It was something arguably more terrifying. Oblivion.
Oblivion.
Yes. If the heart was heavy, it failed the test. It would be immediately tossed to the floor and devoured by a terrifying monster waiting beside the scales. Amit, the devourer of the dead.
Amit. What was she?
A nightmare composite. Head of a crocodile, forequarters of a lion, hindquarters of a hippopotamus, all deadly creatures to the Egyptians. Being eaten by Amit meant complete annihilation. Your existence simply ceased. Game over.
Wow. That's a powerful incentive for ethical behavior throughout life, isn't it?
Absolutely. It shows how functional this mythology was. It wasn't just abstract belief. It had real-world consequences for how you lived.
Thinking about that functionality, you mentioned Isis using Heka, magic. Pinch has a specific take on what magic meant to the Egyptians, doesn't she? It wasn't quite what we think of.
That's a really crucial point. Heka wasn't seen as supernatural in our sense, not something that broke the laws of nature. It was a fundamental force of nature woven into creation itself.
So like physics or gravity, but for
okay.
Making things happen.
Kind of, yes. It's the inherent power that underlies creation and allows change. The gods used Heka to create and maintain the universe. Humans could learn to access and use it too. Isis is the prime example of a divine being wielding Heka expertly, using spells, knowing secret names.
So myth wasn't just stories or spiritual guidance. It was almost like practical knowledge, a technology.
That's a great way to put it. Myth contained the essential knowledge, the spells, the designs for amulets, the identities and weaknesses of harmful spirits needed to manage the world. It helped you ward off dangers, cure sickness, ensure fertility. It was a practical tool set for navigating life and the cosmos.
We see this complexity, this sort of functional duality, even within the gods themselves. Goddesses weren't always just nurturing figures, were they? Pinch mentions an anecdote.
Right. The myth of the destruction of mankind is a perfect example. It shows the terrifying, potentially chaotic side of even benevolent deities.
What happened in that story?
Well, humanity had apparently become rebellious or noisy, disrespecting the aging sun god Ra. So Ra decided to punish them. He sent the goddess Hathor, usually associated with love, music, joy, to sort them out.
But she transformed.
She morphed into her ferocious, destructive aspect. Sekhmet, the powerful lion-headed goddess of war and plague. And she went on a killing spree. A total slaughter.
Uh-oh. Did it get out of hand?
Completely.
Yeah.
Sekhmet got a taste for blood and wouldn't stop. Ra actually started to regret his decision, but couldn't just call her off.
So how did they stop her?
They had to trick her. They brewed thousands of jugs of beer, dyed it red with ochre to make it look like blood, and poured it out across the field.
She drank it.
She saw this vast lake of blood, waded in, drank it all, became completely intoxicated, passed out, and forgot all about her mission of destruction.
Wow. That really shows that even the good gods had these dangerous, chaotic potentials that needed careful management, right? Appeasement, ritual.
Exactly. Nothing was simple. Everything existed in this dynamic tension.
Okay, the real power of Pinch's work, I think, is how it reframes this ancient system, not just as history, but as something offering tools for us now. What can this ancient operating system teach someone listening today?
I think there's some really potent lessons. The first one for me is about cognitive flexibility. Just look at how the Egyptians handled those contradictory creation myths, Memphis versus Heliopolis.
They didn't force a single answer.
Right. They implicitly understood that complex reality, especially something as profound as creation, couldn't be captured by one single theory. They were comfortable using multiple lenses.
So for us, when we face complex modern problems, maybe in business or relationships or society,
yeah,
we shouldn't get trapped seeking the one simple dogmatic explanation.
Exactly. Maybe we should try using multiple, even conflicting frameworks or perspectives at the same time. It might lead to a richer, more resilient understanding than trying to force everything into one box.
That makes a lot of sense. What's another application?
Resilience through cycles. Think about Ra's daily journey, death and rebirth every single night, or the Osiris story tragedy leading to resurrection and renewal.
It provides a framework for enduring tough times.
I think so. It encourages us to view setbacks, failures, or periods of chaos, our personal Isfet moments, not as the end of the story, but as necessary phases within a larger cycle. The sun will rise again, Maat can be restored. It fosters a long-term cyclical view of life, which can be incredibly grounding during difficult periods.
A long-term perspective, that's powerful. Is there a third?
Yes, something about leadership, maybe servant leadership, understood through Maat. The pharaoh wasn't powerful just for himself. His primary role, his divine duty, was to uphold Maat for everyone. His power was defined by that responsibility.
So, for modern leaders, it's not just about quarterly profits or personal ego.
Perhaps not. Maybe it suggests leaders should focus on defining and maintaining their organization's Maat, its core purpose, its ethical principles, its stable, healthy culture, treating the upholding of that order as their fundamental, almost sacred duty.
Interesting. Okay, this has been a really illuminating deep dive. If we had to boil down Pinch's core message.
I'd say it's that mythology isn't just old stories. It's the adaptable, living software of a culture. It's functional, it's constantly updated, and it's absolutely essential for coherence and stability.
And that central conflict, Mahat versus Isfet,
Yay.
order versus chaos, that's timeless, isn't it?
It really seems to be the fundamental struggle of existence, whether you're rabbling Apep nightly in the underworld or just, us trying to navigate the complexities and uncertainties of modern life.
Definitely. So, as a final thought for you, our listener, reflect on that connection the Egyptians made between their physical world, the predictable Nile, the chaotic desert, and their deepest beliefs. What are the Nile and desert landscapes in your world today? What are the sources of order and predictability? And what are the sources of chaos and disruption that shape your fundamental assumptions about how things work?
That's a great question to ponder. What shapes your Ma'at and Isfet?
Something to definitely think about. Thank you for joining us on this exploration. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.